You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, we're going to talk about aviation readiness right now. So what you're going to hear next is a little piece of audio that we did, and it was a comment on the Marine Corps. Actually, it's an extract from his interview, and so you're gonna hear that. All right, so you're going to hear from the Commandant of the Marine Corps on aviation readiness, and then you'll hear General Davis's interview right after that. So All Marine Radio continues, Marine Corps heritage. We're talking about aviation readiness. You're going to hear two of the leaders of the Marine Corps talking about it. More of All Marine Radio coming up right now.
You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue with the Commandant of the Marine Corps here on the inaugural show on All Marine Radio. First of all, sir, let me say it again. Thank you very much for joining us today and making this a big day for All Marine Radio.
Hey, great to be here with you, Mac.
All right. I want to talk about two things real quick, and then I want to talk about post-combat related mental health. First thing is Marine Corps aviation. Much in the news here in the last few weeks, and been seeing it written about extensively over the course of the last year or so. Can you give us a thumbnail? What's the problem? What's the fix? Because when you talk Marine Corps aviation, you talk large dollars. How do we fix it?
Well, it's a combination of things, and it varies between each model type series. So, and long story short, Reader's Digest version is we flew our planes in Iraq and Afghanistan a lot. We probably made a mistake not bringing our helicopters back after every rotation we left them there. So they continue to be affected by the elements. We thought we were going to get the F-35 faster than we did. Or slower than we did. We thought we were going to get it years ago, so we kept F-18s and Harriers longer than we thought. So they're beyond what we thought would be their life expectancy. We tried to run. We've been running them through the fleet readiness centers or the depot level maintenance. Takes longer to get them fixed because they're really in bad shape. Plus, we got affected by sequestration. Some of the workforce got laid off, and they had to go live for work, and so. That, and then we're in the middle of replacing every model type series of aircraft we have, from new Hueys and Cobras to MB-22 Osprey for CH-46, F-35B for Harriers, and F-18s and even EA-6Bs. And then the 53s, which are probably in the most difficult shape because they had airframes bullets in because there was a fire on a Navy one where fuel lines had wiring attached to it, and with the vibration, fuel lines rubbed, the wires, you know, frayed, and then they arced and caused a fire. We had to fix all that. So it is what it is. So we've got a plan. We're continuing to be funded to buy a new airplane. The U.S. has got more F-35s flying right now than they got F-22s between us and the Air Force. Air Force got over 100. We've got one squadron that's initial operational capability. We're going to form another one this summer. We continue to field. We're like 280 out of 360 for Osprey. Still have parts issues with some of the new airplanes because they're continuing to build the line. But we've got a plan. I think we're kind of at the bottom. We're going to dig ourselves out and probably, let's say, 1920. If we continue to get funded to buy new airplanes, then we continue to fix legacy aircraft, and we can continue to get funded for spares, we'll be in a lot better place. I track it every week. Marines are doing a great job out there keeping the airplanes we have on the ramp flying. Air crews are not getting flying up. They have a standard for them to fly, enough hours per model type series. They're just not getting enough hours, and we've got to do better for that. those that are deployed on ARDMUs or with Special Force MAGTAFs that are flying or deployed on UDP to Okinawa, they got the best airplanes, they get enough parts, and they're getting to fly enough. So that's kind of where we are.
You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue with the Commandant of the Marine Corps here on the inaugural.
All right, so that was the Commandant of the Marine Corps. Now, what you're going to hear is General Davis, the Assistant Commandant for Aviation. And he did a kind of a two-part interview with us, so you'll hear that right now. And, again, General Davis, again, Deputy Commandant for Aviation, and join us probably on about the 5th of October. And to talk about these very issues. So I think it's important enough to replay that interview and to hear, you know, what he had to say. So so here is the Assistant Commandant for Aviation, General Davis. We continue on a Wednesday morning. They act like they don't like this song. But they love it. They can't get enough of it. They could, like, they could recite the whole movie, for instance. And joining me this morning, privileged to be joined by the Assistant Commandant for Aviation of the Marine Corps, General John Davis. So first of all, good morning. Thank you for doing this.
Hey, my pleasure, my honor.
All right. The first of all, All Marine Radio. It's a great adventure and dedicated to post combat related mental health and keeping Marines connected to their culture. So it's always awesome when senior leaders, whether it be the Commandant, the Sergeant Major, guys like yourself, come on and make us smart about current events and again, kind of reach out and tell people that that you guys care. So so and tell me that your heart didn't skip a beat when you heard that song.
I remember where I first saw the movie, so it was good. It was actually with my son, who was a 2-year-old at the time, and jumping up and down the chair. I think he was a lot more excited about it than I was. So.
All right. Let's find out a little bit about you, sir. Born and raised where?
I was born in Montgomery, Alabama. My dad was in the Air Force, and I was raised in New York State, all over New York, kind of called Buffalo, New York home. Go Bills.
Oh, ouch. What? How are they going to do this year?
They're going to do great. I think they play L.A. this weekend, don't they?
Uh-oh. The Rams back at home. It's a big deal out here. I'm not going to lie to you, sir.
That's right. I know. It's a big deal to me, too.
All right. So what about how does the Marine Corps, where do you go to college? How does the Marine Corps get on your horizon?
I went to little school in western Pennsylvania, Allegheny College, small school, graduates about 300 a year, studied economics. Had turned down an ROTC scholarship to college when I was in high school because I didn't like the guys who interviewed me. I didn't think they were interesting. Told my father I wasn't going to go in the military. And then as a freshman in college, I was hitchhiking home with a buddy of mine that I was pledging a fraternity with. And he was telling about these guys he met in the campus center. They're in a cult that you could go to boot camp in the summer and no commitment. And asked who they were. They said they were Marines. And I remembered the Rue boys, there were kids I grew up with. The older brothers were Marines in Vietnam. We always looked up to them. So I got my mom and dad's car on the south side of Buffalo. Got in the car, drove this kid to his house on the north side of Buffalo. And I went to the recruiting office on the way home. Didn't tell my parents. And I was a walk-in to the recruiting office, Oso Buffalo. He gave me a test. Gave me another test. And they said, hey, you did really well on that second test. And I said, what was that? And they said, that's the AQT-FAR, that's to be a pilot. And I said, Marines fly? they go, yeah. I said, I didn't know you had airplanes. They go, yeah. We have some guys who just joined to fly airplanes, but why don't you sign up to be a grunt? You can do that because we have a hard time giving those contracts away in 1977. And
right.
And then you can be transition to aviation in your senior year if you want. And that's exactly what I did. So I went off to Quantico to Camp Upshur in 1977. Lit up my life, changed a lot of things for me. Average candidate with average prospects for success in Marine Corps. went back to the second increment in 1977, and it was wonderful. And went to the basic school in 1980. Company commander was a guy named Captain Conway. I still hang out with my friends. That were from my basic school classmates to this day. Yeah, it was good. So I love it. I joined the Marine Corps to be a Marine, and the airplanes that I've flown are tools to support the Marine on the ground and be what I consider to be a part of the greatest military invention in the history of warfare, which is the United States Marine Corps team, an air ground logistics team. And team is, you know, it's the operable word. It's the way we think, the way we process data, the way we do stuff, and we exist for the team. So it's been an honor to be a flyer in that lash up.
So you fly the Harrier, and, you know, at the time that was, you know, the Harrier was just being introduced to the Marine Corps. That was not for the faint of heart. What was that experience like?
Well, it's interesting. When I was going through flight school, you know, initially, like most young guys, I wanted to fly Cobras first, and then I wanted to fly jets. So I did pretty well in primary, got selected to jets, went to Meridian, Mississippi. You know, you go through flying with instructors. First it was the Intruder, then it was the A4, then it was the F4, and then the Falklands happened when I was in flight. You know, the Harrier did a really good job down there. The Marines had the Harrier. Back there was the AV-8A, which is the old English airplane. They were fairly selective about who they brought into it. But I was doing really well in flight training, and I was going to be in the Marine Corps for 3.5 years. And I thought that would be the airplane. That to me, it looked like a Marine machine. It was based close to the grunts, designed to do close air support. So I figured that was what I was going to do for a living and at least for 3.5 years of my life, and dedicated myself to doing that. So I decided to fly the Harrier in 1982, went and did that. So, I'll tell you, the airplane, if you follow the rules, if you were disciplined, was actually fairly forgiving. If you didn't follow rules, it will light up your life. So Marines are disciplined, so good Marines are good, a good disciplined Marine will be a good Harrier pilot. I tried just to be a good guy, flying that airplane. And I never lost track of why I was flying it, you know.
Interesting. So I want to talk about your career, obviously a long, distinguished career. I'm going to limit you to two, okay? And you can't tell me, Matt, there's too many. If I don't mention somebody, you know, it's not fair. Give me two people that have had a huge impact on your career, two leaders.
Okay, this one might surprise. The first one will be General Krulak. I'd gone through my career, been a exchange pilot of the Royal Air Force, WTI exchange officer of the Royal Air Force. Went and been an instructor at Mach 1, and that was a great tour. Went to command staff, and then went to this thing called School of Advanced Warfighting.
Right.
On the backside of that, I wrote some thought pieces about the Marine Corps and the future and what we're doing, and I got called up to be in an interview with General Krulak to be a speechwriter for him. So I was an analyst and a speechwriter for General Krulak for 2 years. I learned a lot about the Marine Corps, and I learned a lot about senior leaders from General Krulak. I learned from General Krulak to speak my mind, to be ready to defend my positions, to hold my ground, and that bottom line, senior leaders need thoughtful input to the things they're trying to decide on, and that I learned that a four-star general would listen to a major and take his input. I'm still very close to him. I think the world of him. I think he was a very positive impact on our Corps.
A life-changing experience, though, intellectually, in terms of Saw and Sam. I know I have great friends that have gone through there, and you know, my friends talk about two experiences in their career, my close friends. We served together at the basic school. John Allen, John Kelly, Lou Craparata, Phil Smith, Stacy Clarity, Jody Osterman, General Amos, General Milstead. and all happened just coincidentally to be there at the same time. And in the late 80s, early 90s, we wrote, we were tremendously critical of each other in public, and but had a great time, but really began the process of discovery into this profession of ours that was embracing maneuver warfare. How did it apply to the Marine Corps? How did it lay down in training? How did it lay down institutionally? And it was just an incredible intellectual experience, and I think most would point to that and say I separated, I think, a little bit from my peers because intellectually I was down the road in this exploration of it. And then the other thing they point to is many of them went to School of Advanced Warfighting, and the intellectual impact on that them from that school and the doors it opened to them for experiences like the one you had.
I'll say, here's my SAW class. Myself, Dave Berger, Mike Dana, Vince Stewart, Mark Balakis, Robert Mood, who was ended up running the Norwegian Army. It was crazy good people in my class, 5 3-stars in my class at SAW. So as an aviator, going in there and going, hey, this could be a waste of time. I said, well, I'm not really worried about my career. But it just seemed like at that time something I really wanted to do was, again, you're thinking about warfighting and thinking about the future, and so that to me was probably one of my best years in the Marine Corps.
Interesting.
I done a master's thesis on urban close air support, and that driven kind of my experience being a attack pilot on the kind of the closest jet base to the East German border back in the late 80s with the RAF.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thought maybe there was going to be a different kind of fight than other people were thinking about.
Were you right?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. Well, I believe so. We never fought that fight, but I think the future fight would have been different than the way the Brits thought it would unfold. And I was having a hard time with the weapons, the target matching we were doing out there. And I felt that they could have been a little farther ahead than where they were about tactics planning. And then when I was an instructor at MOTS, we always used to get the Harrier guys and the Cobra guys together. And with the Cobra guys came the Task Force 160 helicopter pilots.
Right.
So I remember when Mike Durant and Cliff Walcott were, in my house drinking beer and eating elk steaks, talking about tactics with those Army helicopter pilots. And the next class, Mike Durant was on TV, had been shot down in Mogadishu.
Right.
So I wrote my master's thesis on urban close air support in 1994, dedicated to the Task Force Ranger and the guys we lost over there. But I thought that we could have done a better job providing fires for infantry in an urban environment. I didn't think we were prepared. The Marine Corps at the time was very interested in fighting desert, the desert storm fight again. We were buying big bombs, deep target penetrators, but that was not the kind of, you needed low yield weapons, precision yield weapons to do the urban fight so that the Marines who took a city block wouldn't have to fall back to take a second. They allow you to do close air support to support them. So small yield weapons like blast rag Hellfires and the laser Mavericks are a much better weapon than the other stuff we're using. So General Krulak was the first one. He was really good. The second one is Sergeant Hoffman, who is my sergeant instructor, second increment PLC senior, phenomenal leader, just one of those guys. I almost quit the Marine Corps. I was angry they were going to wash out my best friend, who was a really good guy, George O'Coin, because he had threatened to beat up some idiot who didn't deserve to be an officer. And he was in one of those billets at PLC Senior that, they put him in so they could wash him out. But
right. The
guy, I can't remember what he'd done, but he'd done something stupid to my platoon when I was in charge, and George threatened to beat him up. So the guy turned him in, and George got boarded. Luckily, George carried the day, but Sergeant Hoffman, reminded me that candidate O'Coin would come out on the other end, he'd be just fine, and that some of the people that were judging him at that time really weren't the kind of Marines I was going to meet in the fleet. So I listened to Sergeant Hoffman. Candidate O'Coin became Lieutenant O'Coin. It's my father's or my son's godfather, and I retired George O'Coin as a colonel in the Marine Corps Infantry Officer at Twin Palms a few years back, and so it's great. So Sergeant Hoffman, so he was one of those guys I always thought about. Like, he had such a positive impact. He was the quintessential enlisted leader. If there is a if there's a Jim Conway, you know, guy there at the basic school, I think about the finest enlisted leader I ever knew is Sergeant Hoffman. And so I'm Squadron Commander 29 Palms with, I think it was Colonel Neller,
yes,
with his regiment out there, 29 Palms, you know, 0530, breakfast line,
right,
stand up there. Nobody's went looking for Sergeant Hoffman. I figured he was a sergeant major or something like that. So whenever we got the internet in the Marine Corps, I kept looking around looking for this guy. Could never find him. You know, I tried different rank combinations, never found Hoffman. And then I remember standing there in the chow hall line in 29 Palms, get my sea rats or tray rations, and look left, and there is Chief Warrant Officer 5 Hoffman, regimental gunner. You know, so it was like old home week. Loved it. So, you know, when I retire, he'll be there in the formation. He'll be good.
Okay.
So he's a great, great enlisted leader. Great man.
All right. Sir, what about, give me your combat deployments and then give me a lesson learned from each one.
I would say my combat deployments weren't that extensive. I was more, a little bit more senior. So I was brought in as staff. I was at the weapons school at MOTS 1. I would say the first one was I was brought in to work for General Amos in Kuwait to work on going into Baghdad in an urban close air support environment. We didn't have to do that much in OIF 1, the march up, but I ended up being a logistics planner. And the importance of logistics resupply for our Marines, and using anything you can do to get material to our 4 deployed units. What I learned out there is the immense agility of the Marine Corps and the Marine Corps team in that deployment. So I sat there, I watched General Conway, who was the MEF commander, General Mattis, General Amos, I forget who the MLG was, in our Navy Admiral, who was the CB. But I watched those guys talk about what they were doing and the problems they had. And then very quickly we went back as a wing staff and said, okay, General Mattis said he had this challenge, and we would reconfigure whatever we were doing that night to go solve those problems, right? We would move airplanes out of tanker tracks to go do what we had to do to make sure that they had fuel and ordnance and water and chow. I mean, amazing. So kind of for the Harriers, we actually – as we got farther north, we outstripped our ability to resupply the 4 deployed units. And so we ended up, the reason we 4 deployed Harriers is not because we wanted to 4 deploy Harriers, is I needed those C-130s to deliver the logistics, not gas, to fighters. So we cleaned off a little strip out there where they could take off the ship or the land base out there and land, you know, and basically get gas. We put gas in blibbets out there and go get another chaos mission by having to take gas off a tanker. And then that allowed me to take those 2 or 3 tankers as using for the Harriers, and we could go deliver logistics that night to General Mattis's guys as they were out running around. And we were able to run, you know, initially we were going to stop on the east side of Baghdad. We ran all the way around the east side. I remember we planned one night to go to Kirkuk, and then they said, we're not doing that. We're going to Tikrit. The next night we planned for a movement up to Tikrit, and we were planning fuel deliveries all the way up to the logistics delivery up there. I mean, it was phenomenal, just MAGTAF. The power of the MAGTAF was not its individual parts, but the combination of all of them to achieve operational strategic objectives. So that's that. The second one, I went in to go work for General Amos on his staff and did red team stuff for General Amos on his staff. And there was I learned to be a contrarian, to go basically I had to fight his wing's plan. And the MEF really fought some of the MEF's plan, but fought his plan and looked for gaps and seams out there and try to cover down those gaps and seams. So to me, the value of having a capability like that to me was very powerful. So I think the power of red team, properly configured red team. I don't know if we did it right, but we tried. It was one of the first times we tried to do something like that. But I did that for 3 months in OIF-2.
And then we were talking before we came on. You were the wing commander for 2nd Marine Air Wing, and sent guys forward. Any lessons learned out of that? I mean, I want to say this publicly. I was there doing current operations with RCT-1 and General Furness, and the professionalism of 2nd Marine Air Wing was incredible. And I've said it before on this program, but our Medal of Honor winner, Kyle Carpenter, is alive today because of the partnership that, that was created by the air officers from RCT-1, our dust-off, medevac guys, and your TACSWO and ops guys without that partnership. And it was emblematic of the entire time we spent together. Kyle Carpenter's not alive, in my opinion. And I watched it. I did it. And so talk to me about getting guys ready to go and as a wing commander and then launching them forward and that experience.
Well, that was General Walters and his AWC was at the time a Colonel Sanborn that went forward. I think, you know, bottom line, they did the hard work out there. We basically put the very best guys in the wing and the forward. Everybody knew why we were going and what we were doing. And why we were there is to support the MACDAF and support the guy on the ground. So I think that's the way it's supposed to be. So I'm immensely proud that they did, that the customer thought they did as well as they did. And bottom line is that's why we do what we do. So I think I'm very proud of all the Marines that went forward. And frankly, today, the MACDAFs we built today, like the MACDAFs we built back in 2010, go forward and go support the guy on the ground and do our job incredibly well in difficult conditions. So we're continuing to do that today. So I'm very proud of the efforts that we're putting together to put forth that at the strategic level from all four of our wings to support the Marines that are forward deployed. You know, as, whether it's maybe today a hurricane relief on the East Coast and the Caribbean.
Right.
Or forward deployed going after, you look at what's going on in the Meuse right now, off of Libya. 2G Meuse is doing incredible work. The 13th Meuse just got back from the Gulf, did incredible work. We have carriers getting ready to deploy with Marine Squadrons embarked and our special purpose MACDAFs. And let's not forget those Marines who are forward deployed in the Asia Pacific right now,
right,
keeping the peace and deterring aggression out there. In the 1st Marine Aircraft Wing, and those folks are in the unit deployment program support of 1st Marine Aircraft Wing. I mean, I think incredibly busy period for the United States Marine Corps. And frankly, you know, for the size that we are, we're expending a hell of a lot of ordnance, very, very effectively. And, we're fighting above our weight each and every day at the Corps from sea bases and shore bases.
Our hallmark, fighting above our weight. One of the cool things about doing this is Marines from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and the stories they tell about us consistently fighting above our weight. But that's what we do. Nobody shrinks from it, right? Everybody tightens their belt and says, hey, look, it's my turn now. The long shadow of the Iwo Jima flag raising, that thing casts its shadow for a long distance. And I think most of us, whenever we go, say, look, it's my turn now, and there's no way in hell I'm going to let that thing down. And so it's a very cool thing to watch. I want to naturally, the conversation, will migrate to readiness. So we're going to take a quick break right now. We're going to come back. We're going to continue a discussion with Lieutenant General John Davis, Deputy Commandant for Aviation, as we continue on a Wednesday here on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right. That's part one. So you're going to hear part two right now. Without a break, we're talking about aviation today. So this is the DCA for aviation here on All Marine Radio. And that sounds like part one. That's awesome. We continue on a Wednesday morning. They act like they don't like this song.
Oh, my God. Just shut up already.
But they love it. They can't get enough of it. They could, like... they can recite the whole movie.
There you go. Part two.
I'm not afraid to on-air produce. All right.
Continue on a Wednesday. My guest this morning is Lieutenant General John Davis. He's a Deputy Commandant for Aviation. And so the natural progression of the discussion, kind of when you're talking about, you know, operating in the Pacific and everything everybody's doing currently is readiness. And there's been...
Obviously, it's a huge story relative to the Marine Corps, and so I wanted to ask you to paint a picture for everybody in terms of the factors that go into readiness. I kind of wrote four of them down: use, the F-35, SLEP, and then sequestration and the impact that sequestration had on the what I would call the almost Disneyland like Imagineer guys that work on in the F-18 SLEP program. So could you that's my crude infantryman's kind of broad brush of the factors that go into how the Marine Corps got where it is today. Could you give us a thumbnail of a better, more informed version of that in terms of how we got to where we are today?
Yeah, I think I'll kind of anchor on the use thing first. I think that's one of the bigger ones. And so I would say we've been in a sustained period of combat for 15 years of sustained combat. We're a small force designed, you know, the force in readiness, small force designed to be highly ready. So we don't have a tiered readiness model like the Navy might have. All of our units are designed to be highly ready, what we would call T2.0, which is basically they can get up and get out the door and go do the job in any client place against any adversary, and you'll have enough depth of training inside that unit to go do that job. The challenge we've had is after 15 years of combat, we've worn out a lot of our aircraft. Specifically, you know, we're going to talk about the fixed wing TACAIR or F-18s and Harriers, and we have been slow to replace them.
Can I stop you there and ask you a question?
Yeah.
All right. Slow to replace them. To me, this dynamic budget, when we go to war and we're using this stuff up, that's fairly predictable. And so it's a conscious decision by elected officials to keep funding at a certain level that either allows us to replace or doesn't allow us to replace aircraft. Is that fair?
It is, but what I'll also say is all of the airplanes we're buying right now, that our transition plan was actually in place before September 11th, 2001.
Okay.
Our transition plan. And I'll tell you, we went and fought in 2001, you know, with some of the first guys across the beach, and a lot of times off carriers and amphibious ships with Harriers and F-18s, and then Task Force 58 with General Mattis going up into Afghanistan early. And bottom line, so then we did Afghanistan, we did Operation Iraqi Freedom, came back, and then I'll tell you, and then back into Afghanistan, I'm not sure that any of the planners planned to go as long as we did out there. And frankly, a lot of the Marine aviation, even when the big units came back, a lot of the Marine aviation units stayed forward deployed.
Right.
Special purpose MAGDAFs, you know, that's something we came up with here to go deal with combatant commander requirements. In the last couple of years, we still have a requirement to stay forward deployed in Japan to go keep the peace in the Asia-Pacific, but also to all the requirements out there. So I think the demand for our services and our capability, and frankly, we're very good at it, what we do. People want you want Marines and Marine Air on your side, on your team, forward deployed. And frankly, our deployment to dwell, our operational tempo has exceeded our ability to sustain that. So I'm not going to throw a rock at politicians or anything like that. So I'm not. We exceeded our ability to sustain that. So we're on track now to go replace some of those airplanes. But the F-18.
All right. So is it fair to say that? And I'm not throwing rocks. I'm just trying to explain. So those platforms are getting used up at a higher rate than was teethed into the replacement solution. So you have a little bit of gapposis. That's a technical grunt word, sir. You have gapposis setting in terms of the replacements coming, and yet we're using this thing up, and it's not gonna last as long as it should because we're using it at a higher rate. And then in that gap, we have a decision of what the F-18 Echo or the F-35, the Marine Corps Ops F-35. The F-35 is delayed, and so that's kind of the path. And so again, that's my crude explanation. And you're on here today. in terms of how we get to where we are today. Is that fair?
Kind of fair. What I'd say is the it's not just about F-18s. Even like our V-22s. We Ford the V-22 declared initial operating capability in 2007, and it deployed directly to Iraq. And we've been kind of surge mode in V-22 since 2007.
Wow.
So right now, it's, you know, V-22 is probably the most in-demand airplane in the world. And frankly, right now, V-22 pilots don't go to EWS. They don't go on factors. We can't make them fast enough. I can't make V-22 maintainers fast enough to meet with the demand of a. We're not even fully operationally capable in V-22, but we're adept to dwell about 1 to 2. You know, we've got so 2 special purpose MAGDAFs, 3 Marine Expeditionary Units. That if you do your normal force application model, that'd be, I've got 1 4 deployed, 1 in workup, 1 in recovery. That's 15. Not until just recently did I have 15 V-22 squadrons. So for a number of years, we had 13 squadrons supporting really a 15 squadron operational commitment. And
wow.
So we've kind of outstripped our ability to supply spare parts to the airplane too, because we've been using the airplanes faster than we thought we had ever used an airplane called V-22. The same thing's happening with our C-130s. You know, our attack helicopters, we now have a little bit of respite. We're not forward deployed in Afghanistan. But, you know, so we're recovering there. But I would say the entire fleet has been used and used well, acquitted itself very, very well. And now we're basically recovering a little bit. On the attack air side, you know, Harriers a couple years back were in deep trouble. And we did an independent range review on the Harrier, and we figured out without a lot, didn't take a lot of money, didn't just take some additional focus and doing things a little bit differently to get Range back to where Harrier needed to be. Frank, right now, Harrier is okay. Every day, check with all my platforms, but they're doing really well. The readiness is up, and the flight hours are up in AVA, and they're acquitting themselves very well, both in the Marine Expeditionary Units, four deployed in Japan, and also, too, on our special purpose MACDAF. We do a rotation with the F-18s there, four deployed. And, you know, we've made the Harrier a different machine than the one that I flew when I was a junior officer, that's for sure.
Right.
The F-18, we're actually recovering our readiness in F-18. So we needed to put more attention into sustainment and fixing the old airplanes than we had in the past. Okay, we had a SLEP program for F-18 that we had funded back in 2010 or 8, whatever, I can't always, but we didn't do it. I think we, you know, or 2000, I can't remember when we didn't do it, but we didn't do the SLEP. And that's extended life program, right? Extended life program. We didn't do that. So we're doing some things now with the F-18 to get the life back in the airplanes. And so, I think low point last summer, we were running about 8.8 hours per pilot per month, and that was not acceptable. We should be executing right around 15.7 to 16 hours a month for F-18. Today, I'll tell you, we're about 15.9 hours a month per pilot in F-18s. I'm going to factor, that's not the whole story.
Roger.
So I've got one squadron that's flying about 45 hours a month, right, doing really well.
Mm-hmm.
But they're 4 deployed.
Right.
So on average, if I was a factor of that squadron that's doing really well out, that's skewing my numbers in a positive direction, I'm about 12 hours a month per pilot in the F-18 community right now. Not where you need to be, but about, you know, 2.5 hours more per month per pilot, and we're on track to recover the F-18 readiness. The F-35s are now starting to come into the fleet. So I've got the second operational squadron stood up, and one of the things we're doing to mitigate, we've got life left back in Harrier now, we're actually going to move F-18 squadrons forward in the transition schedule. So we're going to keep Harriers going a little bit longer. We're going to shut down a couple F-18 squadrons. Actually, the next 3 to transition will be F-18 squadrons, 122, 314, which would be an F-35C squadron, and then a CBD, but it looks like it could be 225, an F-18B squadron would be the next F-35B squadron out there. So we're going to start to come in. We're building, coming soon here, 20 airplanes a year, F-35Bs. We're also getting some F-35Cs. So we're now in that transition now with F-35. I'll tell you, I don't lose any sleep at all about the airplanes we're buying for the attack air fleet for the United States Marine Corps. The F-35 is exactly the airplane we want. The guys are flying it, both in the weapons school, in Twin Palms, in Nellis, it crushes the opposition. It crushes the opposition in the air and on the ground. It's great capability. And a lot of people have said, hey, that might be too much technology for the Marine Corps. Or you need a high-low mix. You need a mix of high-capability aircraft and low-capability aircraft.
Right.
High-capability airplanes, F-35. I've got the low mix already. I'm buying 380 H-1s. That's my level of effort, you know, close-in ground attack airplane. We got that. Got a good airplane there. Buying the F-35 for the high-end stuff. You ever hear of General Peterson?
Oh, absolutely, sir.
Yeah, so first African-American general officer, aviator, three-star. I went to go see him before he passed away about 2 years ago. Went to his house out there in Maryland to go say, I'm going to kiss the ring. It was the new deputy commandant for aviation. Said, I'm out here to kiss the ring and see if you think I've got anything that's screwed up. And he goes, well, give me an example. And he said, well, some people think we're buying too much technology, B-22, F-35. And he goes, too much capability. He goes, yeah, some guys think we should be buying something less. He goes, well, I was shot down in a Corsair in Korea and shot down in a Phantom in Vietnam. He goes, I never once thought I had too much technology under my ass. He goes, go tell them they're idiots. You know, Marine Corps doesn't get a chance to pick. We don't pick where we're going to fight. You, like you said, when our time comes, we go. Doesn't matter who the opponent is, right?
Right.
So it doesn't matter. I think you ought to have a force in the United States that we're just born to think we can get the crap out of anybody in any situation, anytime, any place, whether it's one Marine or it's a MEF. Well, I choose to give my Marines the very best technology, the very best weapon system we can. That's the F-35. So it's coming in. None of my children, none of my airplanes are without their warts.
Right.
This one's got a couple, but they're pretty good warts compared to all the other ones. So I don't want to buy a Super Hornet. It's great for the Navy. They can have it. But I'm buying F-35s for the Marine Corps. And we're going to be very happy with that airplane. We already are happy now. In the battles that loom in our nation's bow, the big one ever comes, we're going to want that airplane. Overhead our Marines, providing close air support and everything else for them.
Sir, I teased this yesterday on the show, and I asked, hey, if anybody has any questions, send them to me. And I've got a couple for you relative to readiness. The issue of proficiency versus currency. Do you have an hour threshold that you circle and say, hey, 5 hours gets you proficient, gets you current. It takes 20 hours to get you proficient. We hear those terms by pilots all the time. Is there a threshold that you look at and say, you know, it's not hard and fast, but generally, if a guy's flying this much, I think he can be proficient. How does that make sense to you?
Here's, you know, our target. Again, we don't do tiered readiness. The Navy does that. We don't. We can't afford to. We're a force in readiness. So I can't give you the numbers over this line here, but a very large percentage of the Marine Corps goes forward for the big ones. All right? So we are student body right. We cross the line of departure in large numbers when need be. But I'll tell you, so every one of my type model series has a training and readiness manual. And that gets each one of those units, lays out a path to be that T2.0 unit that can go fight across the spectrum and carry the day. Roughly, I get concerned when I see anything less than 15 hours a month. Most of them are between 15.7 and 21 hours a month, like a C-130 guy, 15.7 for a Harrier guy. When I see below 15 hours a month, I know we're not executing what we need to be. So we're not as proficient as we need to be. There are minimum currency things that allow you to be safe, right? But proficient is like the quarterback that's taking snaps. It's, you know, you're in your groove. That's the T2.0 force. That's between 15.7 and 21 hours a month. But if I was to have a red line, it's 15 hours a month.
Roger. Okay. All right. Awesome. That's a great answer. The next question, pilot hours and then retention. And then structural flaws in terms of repetitions for pilots. And so let me explain that. And I probably don't need to, but I will for our listeners. You have a generation of pilots now that have grown up in the last few years that have flown much less than their predecessors. They will stay in the Marine Corps, much like a physician Good judgment is a function of casework. As you get older, you do a lot of cases. Your judgment as a physician tends to get better. Also, with flying less comes a bit of disillusionment, if you will, and the demand for airlines, and so guys want to fly and they go other places. How do you mitigate that?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I think it's you're spot on. You know, I remember I had a commanding officer said he thought I'd rather fly than eat. And I thought those were extra words. Why would you have to say something like that? Because that was exactly true. All I cared about was flying an airplane. I wanted to be really good at what I did. And the only way to get really good at what I did is to fly and get snaps. If you ever read the book Outliers, talks about, you know, the best hockey players, the guys get the most ice time, get the most looks at the ball, you get to be good. And that's what I joined. I joined to be a Marine. So I joined to be a Marine, and they said you're going to be an aviator. So I was an aviator and a attack pilot. So I wanted to get as much flight time as I could, and I've done a lot of flying, so I was successful at that. I'll say it's an understatement to say it breaks my heart that I can't get my guys the looks at the ball that they need to have that same feeling. We do have some pilots that are doing very well. The guys who are forward deployed are flying a lot. The guys that are on the bench are the guys and gals that I worry about that are not getting that experience. So. About retention, I never wanted to be an airline pilot, ever. I mean, but I can see why these guys might want to do that because they joined the Marines, they joined to fly airplanes, they joined to support the guy on the ground. They don't think they can be as good as they could be because they're not getting the snaps that they know they need. So my number one job for retention, I've told the Commandant, is to fix readiness, which we're doing. So our plan we're on right now, that's a readiness recovery model inside the Marine Corps. You know, compared to where we were 2 years ago, we have 90 more airplanes on the line that can go fly today than we had 2 years ago. And that's not just new airplanes. That's airplanes we fixed, like 53s and Harriers and everything else. So we have a readiness recovery model that gets us the T2.04s in 2019. It's a long way off. So I'd ask the listeners, if you're Marines or parents of Marines or loved ones of Marines, to bear with us. We are on a path to recover our readiness and basically get back to that ready bench that we had when I was a junior officer. And a lot of times that ready bench is going to be filled with some new airplanes that are pretty King Kong. But we got to fix the ability for people to fly airplanes. Because I'll tell you, there are easier places to go fly. You want to fly? These are a place to go do that. But there is no place like the United States Marine Corps to fly and support Marines. That's the best thing in the world. So I'm fixing the readiness. We're fixing the readiness. They give me a little time, give us a little time. I will put the airplanes back on the flight lines. They get them in the air. They get those snaps. It's coming. And I'm not a pie in the sky kind of guy. The numbers, we're actually getting better. We are flying more hours per pilot per month than we were a year ago, and next year we'd be better. We fight for every single dollar and every single airplane that we have, we're making progress. Commandant General Neller's been on this very aggressively, as you'd expect from our commandant, who understands readiness. He gets it completely, and he wants me to fix it as fast as I can, and we are fixing it as fast as we can. And that will manifest itself with up airplanes on the line, Marine aviators supporting Marine grunts on the ground, both in training and forward deployed. So right now we're putting the emphasis on the forward deployed and doing our level best to get the training that we need to get, like the WTI class is going on right now.
Roger.
It's not what I want, right? I want better readiness right now, but we're basically executing the readiness recovery model as quickly as we can. So they have a valid concern. I've actually been tracking this for a couple of years, and not only tracking it, but doing something about it.
All right, sir. Final question for you. And first of all, I want to thank you for doing this. Obviously, you know, much in the news, and certainly the Marines that listen to this program, who talk shit about the Marine Corps all the time, have questions, and it's awesome to hear it straight from the horse's mouth. I want to switch gears and talk about post-combat related mental health, which is one of the missions of All Marine Radio. Is it okay to put your hand up on active duty and say, hey, I need help? and not have to fear that you're going to be professionally impacted by doing so.
Absolutely, 100%. It is. Yes.
Do you have a message to guys either on active duty or that have got out that struggle with I don't call it what you want, PTSD, their anger issues, after their combat experience? Because, as you know, we're a road hard, put away wet organization, and it's heartbreaking when guys struggle, after they come home and they kind of get away from the Marine Corps a little bit. And that's why we want them to listen to the program. It'll take you to a warm place. It'll bring you back to our tribe. You get your, you know, Marines like General Davis talk, which makes us all feel good because it's home. Do you have any advice for those guys that you give when you meet them and you see them around the country?
Yeah, one, we love them. They are part of the tribe. We want them, if they have a problem, we want them to come get help. I remember as a little guy, growing up in Western New York, the guys who were my heroes were the guys who were running the baseball league, there were the Knights of Columbus, that were Boy Scout, Cub Scout, Weeblo leaders. A lot of these guys were combat vets. How you'd know that because they'd march in the parades,
right,
and they'd stand up the Marine Corps hymn. That's the first time I heard the Marine Corps hymn, is when all these old guys were standing up, to include one of my very best friends, whose dad was a rifleman at Iwo Jima. He was town mailman.
Wow.
They stood up for the Marine Corps hymn. And those were the guys quietly that led our town. I think what I need are, you know, what I'd ask just as a fellow Marine, you know, they've got so much leadership and so much to give and so much to offer, just that they're still Marines and they can be the leaders and be engaged. And, you know, when I retire, I'm going to get a red hat so I can be engaged. I always talk to guys who got out, even my baseball buddies, like, how come you don't go to the ball? That's BS. You got to be going to the ball. You got to be getting engaged. You got to help these Marines who are out there that need help and need to know that you care about them and that we're part of this is the very best fraternity,
right,
you could ever join. We're like the hoplites. We're like the elite. We're the finest fighting force the world has ever seen. Finest fighting force.
Hey, so can I tell you something? People think we're talking shit when I say that. I'm not. If you've seen it, nobody will get it on with you like the Marine Corps. Nobody on the planet. We're day on, stay on. As long as you want to get it on with us, we'll fight you until we kick your ass. We're not
out there running. Yeah, I'm training for a marathon, running out there by myself, probably at age 58, looking like I'm about to fall over dead. And some guy gives me a Semper Fi. Do well in a race, you know. So that's just, yeah, like you said,
here we are.
You know, I'm lucky to marry as well as I did, and lucky to have a couple of kids and grandkids. But joining the Marine Corps changed my life in a very positive way. And I want to go back to guys like Sergeant Hoffman and the village leaders in my little town in Western New York that led that town. Kind of that they were the shadow government, the shadow leaders in that town. They did it very quietly, but they were our combat veterans from World War II and Korea and Vietnam. And, this generation here, I think, is the finest generation of Marines that ever walked the earth. They're 15 years of sustained combat against a nasty foe. We need to covet and love these guys and take care of them. So when I retire, that's what I'll do. I'm going to go out there and find – I found a Marine in Sandpoint, Idaho, is where I'll end up. And this guy was wearing a red hat, and they had a concert out there in the lawn, and the guy was a Vietnam helicopter pilot. And fantastic. You know, we went up there and talked like we were long-lost brothers. Never met him before, but
no,
that's just what the Marine Corps is.
You know, one of the things I found out in doing this program in terms of transitioning, those red hat guys, we make fun of them, you know, the crazy blazer and stuff like that. But when you go home, they've dealt with a VA in your community. They know who the good people are. They know who the assholes are. They know, and they can help you. They can help you with employment. So young Marines tend not to want to do that. And in large part because of the crazy red blazer, and like, that's not me. You know, those are World War II guys. Those are old guys. That organization can take you down the road and help you, and they're it's same tribe, man. So Check in with the Marine Corps League. They are awesome guys. So I know you got to go, and I don't want to hold you up. I got
Red Blazers are a guide on. Right? I mean, for old dudes, a guide on. Yeah. So I do have to go. I want to thank your listeners for listening. If anybody thought I was full of crap, they can get back to me. I'll listen. I don't know. I don't have all the answers, but we are tracking to get better readiness out there across the fleet. That's an important thing. That's why we joined the Marines. Just want to say he's kind of, 4 years ago, lost one of my lieutenants in Afghanistan. He's a squadron commander by the name of Rabel. We went out and his friends went out to Arlington to go pay our wishes to him. He had just finished a close air support mission when he landed, when the bad guys came through the gate.
Right, never mind.
Like a good Marine who was killed with a pistol in his hand, he and Sergeant Atwell. So I still remember the guys we lost every single day. And tomorrow I'm going to go up to Newport, Rhode Island, and go visit the gravesite of my one of my very best friends, the guy I named my eldest son after, Jeff Sharp, a Cobra pilot, was killed in Grenada, Silver Star winner. So you never forget the Marines that went past. You never forget their families. You never forget the Marines that served. And bottom line is, we want the guys who are out there in the first div to be checking in and staying in touch and staying plugged in and never lose the fact that whatever they're doing in life, that they were a U.S. Marine. So incredible accolade for anybody.
All right, sir. First of all, thank you for doing this, and I hope maybe down the road we can do it again. And want to wish you all the best of luck, and appreciate your time this morning.
Yeah, thank readiness. Hurrah.
All right, sir. Thank you. There you have it. That is Lieutenant General John Davis, United States Marine Corps Deputy Commandant for Aviation. How about that? More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Don't go anywhere.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good,
are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.